When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Alva.
On this week's New Statesman podcast, we talk about our interview with Annalise Dodds, and you ask us what future for Labour's trade union link. So we went to the seaside recently, went on a Ferris wheel. Sadly, we did not have time to get ice cream. We didn't go just so we could go on a Ferris wheel, which I think we actually both pretty much immediately regretted. But because the chair of Labour's policy review, Annalise Dodds, was also there as part of our policy review to talk to her about the policy review, her year as shadow chancellor, how she sees the direction of the Labour Party. Alva, it's now on the website, people can read it. But what did you feel the sort of the big take-homes from our interview with Annalise were?
Someone messaged me after the interview went up, someone who works for the Labour Party, and they said, great interview with Annalise. I feel like you've been building up to this for a long time. Because long-time listeners and readers will know that we have been talking about whether Rachel Reeves was going to replace Annalise Dodds as Shadow Chancellor for nearly a year. And we've had lots of discussions about it on the podcast, and at various points we reported on the sort of internal criticisms of Annalise Dodds and the way Rachel Reeves maybe seemed to be posturing slightly for that position. And so this interview kind of brought it all to a close, I suppose, because of course during Keir Starmer's botched reshuffle after the local elections in May and the devolved elections and by-election in Hartlepool, he did end up replacing Annalise Dodds with Rachel Reeves. But this was the first time that she, Annalise Dodds, has really spoken about that year. And it was interesting because, as you say, the two of us did the interview together, and it was the first opportunity that we had to hear from her not just how it felt to have been effectively sacked as Shadow Chancellor and moved to a different role, but kind of how the whole year had gone. I mean, I think there are a few actually quite interesting things in what she said. I suppose the main thing I would say first, it's funny to talk about your own interview, isn't it? I would say that that the main thing is actually that Annalise Dodds is a kind of master of subtext that you, and I hope that we have brought out what is implied at various points and things that she has said. But on the face of it, what she's saying is, yeah, it was annoying a wee bit that there was speculation when I was Shadow Chancellor that I might be moved, because that's not good for the Labour Party. I don't like internecine stuff. Keir's the boss of the team. You know, he's allowed to move us around. I love the Labour Party so, so much. And here are all my thoughts on what we do next. But the subtext is a bit more subtle. And I think that there are far more criticisms there. I don't know if you would agree.
I think that is the case. And it's odd because, so this is, I think, actually the first joint interview that we have done as a politics team since Anoush and I interviewed Andy Burnham way back in 2015, which which is weird because it was one of the things that I wanted us to do more of when I became political editor. In my defense, for quite a lot of time I've been political editor, we've either been in lockdown or in like the teeth of the Brexit votes. And I think it works better because I think, you know, politicians behave differently when there's an audience. It means that, you know, you can divide the fleet so you don't have that thing where you're often outnumbered by the politician and they're bad. But it does make it more weird because it means we're kind of, instead of me being like, so tell me about these things that you brought out in the interview, just like it becomes this kind of, well, these things that I think we did a brilliant job of. Yeah, kind of it feels a bit like that wonderful play with Derek Jacobi and Ian McKellen, where they're both actors. Yeah. Well, darling, I thought one of the very brilliant things in this interview was exactly that. That was a terrible Ian McKellen acted. Let's just cut that appalling digression.
Like, Adrian's definitely going to leave it in now.
I thought one of the really interesting bits was, as you say, this kind of way that it was an interview in which she was, you know, kind of scrupulously loyal, while at the same time doing, I think, lots of quite interesting sort of subtle, well, actually, I don't think it is that great an idea to announce, you know, kind of big things at this stage in the parliament. You know, that's perhaps not the thing to do until later on. There were lots of kind of things which I think, yeah, were subtly revealing of divides within the Labour Party. Actually, I think the interesting thing is, because obviously one of the things that we have disagreed about on this podcast, in print, in the NS's office in Parliament, is about the wisdom of making that switch. I have actually now come around to your way of thinking on it. But one of your sort of criticisms is the argument, yeah, then she kind of should have asserted herself more in post. And in some ways, this interview both is very assertive, but it's assertive in a very Annalise Dodds kind of way.
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I feel like we should run through some of those criticisms, the way she is sort of assertive in an Annalisa Dodds way. I think that it's maybe not the most interesting bit of the interview, but probably the thing to say first is that I think that she really doesn't hold back ultimately in criticizing the people who were briefing against her and also the people around Keir Starmer who didn't stop it. It's quite subtle, particularly with relation to Keir's team. You know, she talks about how she doesn't, you know, I broke the quotes up a bit in the piece, but she talks about how she doesn't believe in red on red fighting in print, doesn't believe that the Labour Party should wash its dirty laundry in public. And she says that she's never engaged with that. And then she says, and I think obviously we've seen quite a large change within the leadership team in Labour. And I think that there's a strong recognition there as well, that it's really important that we're always sending our best foot forwards. And the focus is always on Labour, not red on red. So I think that's very helpful indeed. And I think that that, as you say, it's a very Annalisa Dodds way of putting it, but I think that that is a real dig at Keir Starmer's team and her welcoming the changes that he has made in the past few months, because the problem wasn't just that colleagues were suggesting that maybe she wasn't performing well in the job. It was the fact that Keir Starmer didn't move her, but he also didn't quash those criticisms for a very long time, which was the worst of both worlds. Either you're going to sack her and you do, or you make it very clear that she's your shadow chancellor and she has your full backing. And I'm sure that it was very difficult for her to be in that difficult limbo between the two. She's also, I think there's a real amount of sass. We raised that issue of cut through with her, because that was one of the main criticisms that people made, that she's a very capable politician and a very smart person, but people felt that she just wasn't resonating with the public or managing to land a blow on the very popular Rishi Sunak during the pandemic. And so we just asked her what she thought of that criticism. And obviously Annalisa Dodds is famously one of the nicest people in the Labour Party. So she said this quite sweetly, but she said, you know, I was always very interested to hear from people with their views about what I should have been doing. I still am very keen to hear people's comments. When they're very generalized, it's obviously harder to act on the basis of them, right? And she just gave, like, there was just a little bit of steel in that answer, which was really interesting. But then actually that whole idea of cut through drives right to the heart, really, of why maybe Keir Starmer did decide to remove Annalisa Dodds.
Yeah, as well as that sort of, you know, rather enjoyably kind of, well, you know, it's quite vague. I thought the other interesting bit of that answer was when she kind of goes on to say, well, look, actually, I wouldn't advise anyone as Shadow Chancellor to prioritise cutting through, because your job as Shadow Chancellor is to show that your party is credible, except, you know, not to kind of maximize, you know, people talking about you at the expense of that. Which, yeah, that is the essence of the actual political disagreement at the heart of those changes, right? Then various people with the ear of the Labour leader and the Labour leader himself, Santo, are very much of the view that what they need to do over the next couple of months, particularly at conference, is really set out a kind of couple of flagship, quite radical responses to the big problems of our time. We've seen a bit of that in their summer campaign over jobs. Although obviously the main purpose of a summer campaign, if you're an opposition party, is just to, yeah, basically go, okay, so we have a big list of topics that are comfortable for everyone in the Labour Party to talk about, and everyone in, and it's true regardless of what the opposition party is, and is slightly uncomfortable for a bit of the government, and we can just kind of do a kind of control V, control P kind of approach to just kind of continually spamming that campaign, of which the job stuff, and, you know, with my Wonka channel, there's lots of really worthy stuff in there, right? But its main purpose is that basically everyone in the Labour Party agrees with their policies on jobs. But it is also part of, for them, how they think they're going to, you know, almost everything they do policy-wise now is kind of targeted at that swing bit of the age distribution, you know, kind of basically people aged 35 to 45. Because if you look at the average age since you start voting Conservative in 2017 compared to the average age since you start voting Conservative in 2019, essentially, if you can just drag it, you know, back up to, you know, above 45 into the 50s, then the Conservatives start to have real difficulties. And you can kind of see that divide playing out in terms of her going, look, it's not about cutting through at this stage. And the fact that Keir Starmer very much does want to make a big statement about his Labour Party here in the present day.
We did actually ask Annalisa Dodds explicitly why she thought that she'd been moved. And she sort of said that we'd have to ask Keir Starmer. But that answer is the answer, isn't it? That she really quite clearly lays out the fundamental disagreement between her and Keir Starmer there, or certainly the fundamental disagreement as she sees it. He could well have had a different reason, but I think she made it quite clear that she thinks she was moved because she was working on the economic credibility of the Labour Party and cared about quietly working on that and seeing the ratings go up on that in terms of public confidence, public trust in how Labour would manage the public finances, and quietly working on Labour's credibility in quite specialised economic circles and banking circles and so on, versus a more immediate desire to make attention-grabbing announcements. And I think that's quite interesting because it is completely right what she points out in the interview, that Labour doesn't win if it isn't performing well on economic credibility. I suppose it's an open question whether if you make attention-grabbing spending announcements, you do damage your economic credibility, or whether that's a risk worth taking. Clearly, Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves have arrived at a different conclusion on that to Annalisa Dodds.
Yeah, I think to continue the sort of, and wasn't the interview marvellous, kind of self-congratulatory tone of this section of the podcast, I think you say it is interesting because you really can argue either way. And I think anyone who says confidently, one of the problems I think political parties have is you have to be confident in all of your, you aren't sort of really allowed to go because of how we, you know, how we in the media would respond, and indeed how internal opponents within your political party go. You can't, for example, go, hey, look, we've never had an uncontrolled COVID epidemic with a vaccinated population before, so we don't really know how that's going to work in the winter months, so we're just going to suck it and see, right? You're not allowed to do that kind of thing, which means you kind of end up sort of with, you know, kind of rigid and, you know, kind of going, oh, well, you can't possibly plan for there to be no exams last year, for example. And in opposition parties, it means everyone has to go, no, this tactical approach is definitely the right one. But the point I remember you making, and it's really stuck with me during the reshuffle, was, well, the thing about politics is the more mistakes you make, the easier your job becomes, because you block off more and more strategic options. And I instinctively think the argument that at the start of a parliament, you should just establish some basic facts about your candidate. Yeah, in his case, I think it's basically the time to go, you know, a noun, a verb. Did I mention that I ran the DPP? I'm tough on crime and I'm, you know, like a nice guy, right? Though that should basically, in my view, be the aim of an opposition party in its first couple of years, is just to establish its candidate. And then you do the policy stuff at the point when people might be looking at it. You essentially kind of, yeah, you kind of do the sort of, okay, right, we're in the sort of run up to the election. Now's the time to kind of do the big kind of like, here's our stuff. And I think the risk of not of doing the let's get out early is, one, then the government just steals your best idea. And two, then the government just chips away at it. You know, the mansion tax under Ed Miliband, I think, you know, a classic example of something just got chipped away at and became this kind of continual point. And, you know, it got to a point where it felt like, you know, anyone with a semi-detached house with more than two bedrooms in a marginal seat started to believe they would one day pay this mansion tax. Or indeed, the energy price was where, yeah, the kind of Conservatives did do some things to kind of deliberately sort of steal that policy's clothes and like denude some of its threat while at the same time trying to claim that it was about wanting to live in a Marxist universe. But because of the sort of policy overload of the first year of his leadership, because of, you know, the various problems with stakeholder management, which I think it is, well, I imagine we'll get into this a bit in part two, but I think it is fair to say has improved significantly with most stakeholders, with one very important exception, which again, we'll get into in part two. But I think they now are at a position where they kind of have to hope that the Starmer-Reeves view is right and the Dodds approach at Shadow Treasury is wrong, because they do need, I think, to do that, like, here we are, here are some big policies, here's something which conveys a flavour in a way than the 200... And again, not an exaggeration, they really did announce 200 non-COVID-related policies in their first year. The way that those 200 policies have just obviously not done. So it's an interesting example, I think, of your kind of, yeah, you should... I'm now just using the podcast to commission you, apparently, but you should really should like blog that, not least, because it would mean that instead of me being like, that thing you said that time would be like, that blog on the NS website.
Yeah, well, I think that was actually on the night of Keir Starmer's reshuffle, wasn't it? And you asked what I would do. And I was like, I would just give Angela Rayner her job back. So I think that was, I suppose, the low point of Keir Starmer's year. I'm sure he would admit that too. I do think, as you say, that once you've made quite a few mistakes, the political strategy going forward is much easier because you're just trying to fix them. I think it would be incredibly hard to be leader of the opposition in a pandemic, or it would be hard to be a politician full stop and to get everything right. But when you're watching and you can see people getting things wrong, I think the strategy for recovery is a bit more obvious. With the Annalisa Dodds interview, I hope that people also find the human side quite interesting, because I think that she as a person is quite a fascinating phenomenon in politics and in Labour politics, because she really is very determinedly loyal. For all that we've been sort of teasing out the subtext of different things that she has said, she ultimately took on this job in the middle of the pandemic, was facing criticism from across her party, really from the beginning, when I think it would be fair to say that whatever you think of the criticisms levelled at her, they were perhaps disproportionate given the performance of some other people in the shadow cabinet. And so she was facing all this criticism for quite a long time. She didn't really have very much apparent support from the Labour leader. She didn't hit back at all, and then just graciously accepted her sacking and her move to another job after it had been trailed for ages. Now she's happily doing this new job as party chair, still backing Keir Starmer, outwardly being completely loyal and pro-Labour, because she's sort of thinking in the wider interests of the Labour Party that it's not worth litigating these arguments in public. I think that takes a quite unusual personality type in politics to do that. And I think I'm struck by how rare her approach is. Whether it works or not, I suppose, is a different matter. But I'm just very struck that it would take a lot on a personal level to swallow all of that for an entire year and pretty much forever. I mean, I'm sure in 20 years, if she's giving an interview and she's asked, or even maybe if/when Keir Starmer is no longer leader, but when, because he won't be Labour leader forever, no matter what happens, but maybe in a decade or so, she'll feel freer to be more honest about the year that she's had. But I'm just really struck by the quite determined loyalty there, and her thinking sort of in terms of what's in the interests of Labour rather than just herself. And also on the human side, I didn't put this in the piece because it didn't quite fit and there was lots of other material, but as you know, obviously as listeners and readers know, I've been fascinated by the Annalisa Dodds, Rachel Reeves psychodrama for about a year, and think they're both really interesting, capable politicians. And I'm just struck that actually Rachel Reeves has sort of been in the background of Annalisa Dodds's career since university. So when Annalisa Dodds was appointed Shadow Chancellor, I did a profile of her for the magazine and spoke to friends of hers and people who had worked with her and so on for it, as well as interviewing her. And one of Annalisa Dodds's friends from Oxford was talking about Rachel Reeves being in the year below. And Annalisa Dodds was president of her JCR and then I think went on to be president of the Students' Union for the entire university. And then I'm probably misremembering this. I should have checked my notes on this before I said it, but Rachel Reeves was also involved. I think she was JCR president of her college, and or she was also involved in the Oxford Student Union. At the time, Rachel Reeves was just considered so formidable. So I just find it fascinating that Annalisa Dodds was probably like one of the most successful student politicians in her year at Oxford. She was incredibly well-liked, did really, really well in her degree, and rose to the very top of student politics. But even at that point, she was slightly, not overshadowed, but her style was very different to the kind of brilliant girl in the year below who would give these supposedly barnstorming speeches at students' union meetings and who was considered quite intimidating. I just find that so fascinating that decades on, that's still playing out between the two women. I don't think there's any bad blood between them at all. I think they really like each other. That was a boring bit of our interview that got cut. Annalisa Dodds just being very nice for Rachel Reeves. I mean, it's obviously also silly that so many politicians go to Oxford, that's also a thing that happens. I think Matt Hancock was also in their year in one of their years.
No, it's making me want to kill myself.
But I just think I'm sure that the two women are aware of this, that they have been in each other's lives vying for similar positions for literally decades.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. I think your point about how the tragic thing is actually just how this was still a kind of, is an interesting interview, people should read it, but it really is it is strikingly loyal. And one of the interesting things about the past year, right, is it's not just this quite important disagreement over strategy, you know, and how those two roles need to conduct themselves. It's also a disagreement about how best to advocate for that strategy, because there's another universe, right, in which, and indeed sort of some other shadow cabinet allies of the sort of Dodds approach, basically were at some points trying to freelance their own approach to doing this, which is basically to go, look, you know, the Annalise approach has yielded these like lovely sort of write-ups in the FT, which is actually not that far away from the old fiscal rule of the last Labour leader. These are the bedrocks we need to build. And if we switch, it'll be because we're switching to bigger spending announcements, stuff about the global tax rules, of the kind of thing that we have now started to see in the Reeves era. Now, you can argue about whether or not that would have been better for the Labour Party to have that argument more publicly. It would obviously probably have made it harder to make that switch around. And yet, on the other hand, you have supporters of Rachel Reeves who very much did take the view that, okay, well, if we think this change should be made, then we need to actually advocate for this change to be made. And if this creates difficulties for the Labour Party in the medium term, well, meh. It is a really interesting sort of, not clash of personalities for the reasons set up, but an interesting clash of approaches. Albeit, again, one where I think that actually the strategic argument about which was the best approach, I think, was much more open a year ago, whereas now that argument has taken care of itself, right?
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think, and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Don't forget, you can now listen to our special Germany Elects podcast series, which explores the campaign, the runners and riders, and the big issues ahead of Germany's election on September 26th. Available now on the World Review podcast feed and at newstatesman.com/Germany.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
So this is a question from Isaac, who asks, what is stopping the Labour Party removing their institutional ties to trade unions? It seems like they have dragged the party left of the electorate. Why not be like the Tories, relying on only the membership and parliamentary party? Stephen, what do you think?
I'm going to become even more nasal than I am usually. I actually think this question, as well as having a very short answer, well, obviously I'm ideologically opposed to giving short answers, has a kind of much more interesting historical answer, which is actually this argument's not true. Throughout the history of the Labour Party, the bulwark of keeping the Labour Party closer to the, whether you want to say closer to its right or closer to the centre, whatever, has been the trade union movement. And actually that was true even in the Corbyn era, right? Now, you have lots of general secretaries who are positioning in terms of their own internal electorate in a way which would make you think publicly, oh, that's not true. But actually, the votes that frustrated Corbynism, I think one of the things that often people don't quite seem to get is that you have to understand Corbynism both as an ideology about the economy and society, but also as a theory of practice of how the Labour Party should operate. And in terms of frustrating Corbynism both as an ideology, in terms of, the position on nuclear power, the various negotiations that had to be had about sanding off some of the edges of the Green New Deal, changes to how MPs face selection, indeed, the composition of the 2017 intake, those are all examples of trade unions in the present day moving the Labour Party. Now, obviously, these terms are all imprecise. As I was saying that, I can already imagine, I actually could name, except it would be terrible source provision, the two Tory MPs and three Labour MPs are going to angrily text me going, actually, being radical on climate change is not a left-right issue. We should use our interest. But regardless, right, these are all issues in which, in terms of the sort of, if we want to use the term centre ground as not like a sort of there's the left here and the right here, but where the modal British voter is, right? These are all examples of Corbynism being moved by the actually existing trade union movement. And that's even before you get into the really basic argument then, like money. The Labour Party does need money to operate. And most of that money does come from the trade union movement. And even at the height of the New Labour in power forever, the sun will never again rise on the Tory party, even in the sort of, those kind of, like those heady, like early noughties days, they were still the biggest individual donors. Now, actually, some of those stats are slightly, we shouldn't forget them because we bulge in councillors as a Labour affiliate. Councillors are also a pretty big contribution, so directly elected people tithing to Labour. But, the trade unions keep the lights on, and they also, it just, I think, is more complicated than the trade unions keep the Labour Party on the have moved the Labour Party to the left. Also, I think, actually the interesting institutional tension in the Labour Party is the platonic form of the Labour Party, as envisaged by many general secretaries, including ones who might surprise you, is actually to have some form of the Electoral College back. Yeah, where you had a third for the trade unions, a third for the Labour MPs, and a third for party members. And some of them, you know, when they've had, you know, a couple more drinks, might even then go, look, ultimately, do we even really need the third for the party members? So, yeah, I think it is just a bit of a misread in addition to everything else.
I thought that was a really interesting answer. Maybe as a rare follow-up, you ask us just a question from me to you. How do you think that Keir Starmer, in particular, relates to trade unions? Because there's been some new developments with that recently, but how would you characterise his relationship to them?
Right, so this I think is actually a really interesting, and it's what I realise whenever I say and underwritten, it's like, and whose fault is that, Stephen? Whose job is it to write on these topics? A thing that I really should have got my skates on and written on more. And obviously there are lots of people writing interesting things on this, not least Alex Maguire, who's written a piece for us and written various pieces for Left Foot Forward, Sienna Rogers at Labour List, of course. But the interesting thing is that the leader's office has really, I think it is fair to say, taken quite a significant step change in terms of how it approaches. The mood music around it is definitely changing, albeit quite imperceptibly. It really does remind me of the kind of late 2016 changes where it actually took ages and really took until the 2017 election for people to just be like, oh, has the leader's office become more well-organized? But actually that had happened a long time before. There is, however, I think one important, quite interesting blind spot in the new setup, which is when you talk to a lot of Gen Zs, they still feel like this leader's office doesn't really understand them and their issues. Yeah, one of them said, you know, I just feel like, you know, they kind of like they're sort of basically inclined to kind of go, oh, you know, ASLEF, TSA, RMT, they're all the same, right? They're all transport unions. They're all on the left. And yeah, they kind of said, yeah, I feel like they don't understand, like, you know, the differences between, you know, the internal issues in Unison versus the internal issues in the GMB. Now, of course, Keir himself is and always has been, right, the candidate and the sort of product of Labour's soft left establishment, or, wow, God, I realise I really have admitted defeat on my war on the term soft left, because I usually use the term middle of the party, but even I've accepted it's not going to happen. I have stopped trying to make fetch happen. But yeah, he's always been the candidate, therefore, of Unison, that bit of the party. I'm fairly certain, yeah, Unison did endorse him in his selection bid, and yeah, the candidate of the sort of middle of the party, right? And we see that still manifesting itself in all kinds of ways, not least what was the biggest and most controversial move he made in terms of the PLP in his shadow cabinet. It is appointing Ed Miliband and restoring him to a pretty prominent spot. But one of the things it does feel like there's a fascinating kind of lacuna in both his own sort of approach and his leader's office still around the sort of trickier inner workings of the trade unions. One trade union official said, well, you know, they said, I think it's a consequence of the fact that actually he hasn't been in politics very long and he hasn't really come into contact with many of the affiliated unions. They said the CPS, not to tip the politics of this particular trade union, they said the CPS might have mad trotty politics. They said, but it's actually like fairly easy to understand how it runs. They said it's not like my union where it's really kind of like, well, how long have you got? And I think that is an interesting, I imagine it will, something will take care of itself, but I think it is an interesting issue for them, because in terms of if they want changes to how the party operates, now obviously they have a big set of changes to how the party operates in terms of the EHRC changes, but of course, although there will be a lot of theatre at Labour Party conference, and that theatre might be painful and embarrassing for the Labour leadership, at the end of this process, right, this is something that's been enforced on them by the regulator. So what's actually really at stake with the EHRC changes is, does the Labour Party get to carry off like kind of pretending that this is a process where it's like, we're doing this, you know, look how we've changed? Or does it have the sort of humiliation of the regulator being like, you haven't done this, now it's going to be done to you? Which is, you know, politically going to be quite important, but it's not, you know, the same as, it's you know, it is a very different kettle of fish, I think, to, you know, the rule changes to, like, you know, change how you select candidates, change how you elect the Labour leader, change how you can remove the Labour leader, all of that kind of thing, all of which does run through the trade unions. And yeah, and despite what you read in version of the paper, and despite the kind of assumptions in the original question, in many ways are closer to that, in my view, wrongheaded, that attitude than, you know, the Collins review was a disastrous mistake, one member, one vote is terrible, and then, you know, the Labour Party is at its best when it's essentially an arrangement between the trade unions and the PLP, with some things called the members, whose job it is to like deliver leaflets and occasionally provide an MP from their ranks, which yeah, I don't think is a good way of running the Labour Party. But actually, that would be if you said to people, if you said to a lot of fairly senior people in the trade union movement, look, you can close your eyes, write your ideal structure for the Labour Party on a piece of paper. It'll be implemented and no one will ever know what you wrote on your piece of paper. That is the structure that they would end up with.
And of course, just quickly, Unite has a new general secretary in Sharon Graham. I wrote about it at the time in terms of how I think that was a result that has simultaneously kind of pleased everyone in Labour and kind of annoyed everyone in Labour, in that she hadn't been widely expected to win and wasn't really any faction's candidate, even though she's from the left. So now everyone in Labour is kind of making a case for why her election is great, while also probably being privately disappointed that their preferred candidate didn't win. But actually, she's a really interesting case where it's not so much about the Labour Party, even though you kind of feel obliged when you're reporting on this, especially as a political correspondent, to talk about its relevance to the Labour Party first and foremost. But in a way, her victory is just much more about delivering for the members of Unite, and much less to do with how Unite relates to the Labour Party, except insofar as from everything that she has said, Sharon Graham is not terribly interested in the internal machinations of the Labour Party. And you can imagine that she will hold Keir Starmer's feet to the fire on particular issues that are of concern to her members, but she won't be engaged so much in factional disputes.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because, yeah, All elections in trade unions are about small L Labour politics, not big L Labour politics. But, you know, because of the various changes in the structure of Fleet Street, the fact that, you know, very few newspapers now have sort of a proper Labour rights, proper Labour correspondent. Lots of them have big L Labour correspondents. It means they do get covered increasingly solely through the prism of, well, what does this mean for the Labour Party? And yeah, you're exactly right. And then despite the fact that her political positioning and that of Gerard Coyne, who came third, I mean, ultimately, you know, I kind of think if a large number of people in the Labour Party genuinely thought there was a serious prospect, I mean, you can kind of come up with a sort of abstract scenario in which Gerard Coyne could have won, despite having had his organising base essentially dismantled after his close run thing last time. But it was just always so unlikely, right? And they should always have been kind of hoping for this in lots of ways. But broadly, elections in trade unions generally have two messages. One is the union is going well, let's not experiment with change. And then there's the, you know, things could be better. Essentially, you know, to use a student union example, because I imagine that works to be more resonant for a lot of our listeners, is a kind of students for students. Let's like do more stuff for ourselves. Let's make the union run better. Now, of course, in many ways, that was also Gerard Coyne's campaign, both this time and last time. And actually, despite all of the kind of, you know, it turned out hilariously wrong-headed sort of bashing of Sharon Graham for splitting the left vote, I think if anything, she and Coyne were always a greater threat to one another, simply because they were both running as the let's change the status quo, whereas Steve Turner was running as the status quo candidate. Now, I do think a big part of what happened in this election, a big part of why Len McCloskey was narrowly re-elected last time, was that Unite had just had a very good result in terms of the Jaguar Land Rover deal. And obviously Unite, as with most unions, had a mixed time in the pandemic, not least particularly difficulty for Unite in aviation. And Sharon Graham is seen, I think, rightly and fairly, as being responsible for lots of the things in Unite that work well. I think less fairly, Steve Turner was seen as being responsible for the things about Unite that work badly. Now, I think that you're exactly right. Then what I think will be a change for Labour is they will go from having an argument with Unite about personnel, yeah, preferred candidates, in terms of, to an argument, actually, in some ways, it will be a lot more similar to the one they have with the CWU. Now, Dave Ward, the first sort of trade union leader to properly stick his neck out for Jeremy Corbyn, CWU's general secretary, I think also probably actually the most influential in terms of policy in the Corbyn era, in terms of specific policy gets that, you know, were driven by him and his team, rather than kind of like, yeah, that's just what Jeremy Corbyn believes. And yeah, the political director of a certain trade unions can pretend in their yearly annual review and it had something to do with them, but it didn't really. He also ran on the union could be running better, let's do more for ourselves, against Billy Hayes, who was also seen as being on the left. And I don't think anyone would say that they thought Dave Ward had been bad for Corbynism. Now, of course, because of Unite's sheer size, they will continue to be really influential in selections, rule changes, a bunch of other things. But I think that the big step change for Labour, and one that I think Keir Starmer's office will probably find a bit weird to adjust to, will, I think, be much more sort of muscular engagement over specific policy asks and less sort of direct day-to-day involvement in the sort of internal divisions. But, you know, because of their size, right, and this actually, I think, is to come back to the original question, right, the really interesting thing about the Labour Party is the Labour Party, you know, not just trade union structure, but everything about it envisages a world of work before the rise of sort of mega corporations, mega-sized trade unions, mega-sized everything, right? And that does make the Labour leader's job harder because they always, you know, ultimately, you're powerful on the NEC if you're the Labour leader, if you have multiple routes to your NEC majority. You become weaker. And this was always Corbyn's difficulty. He had a majority, but it was a majority that only ran one way, right? It ran through Unite and through the member section. So when he wanted to, you know, when he was at odds with one of those components, he was kind of hemmed in. He didn't have alternate routes to his majority. That is harder for all Labour leaders. That's a secular change because we have more, well, we have fewer but bigger trade unions involved in the Labour Party, stronger on the conference floor, more representation on the NEC, and therefore less freedom to manoeuvre for the Labour leader. And that doesn't really change, even though, of course, I imagine some of the negotiations will be on slightly different things, on slightly different issues, as a result of the change of leadership at the top of Unite. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Stephen Bush, and our political correspondent, Alva Ray. It's produced and recorded by Adrian Bradley. Our music is Devil with the Devil and is licensed under Creative Commons. If you've been enjoying the New Statesman podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe. And if you've already done those, why not tell a friend to do the same?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.